10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGT just after she ascended to the throne upon her father's death. The story is told from three perspectives: Elizabeth herself, one of her servants, a young girl named Hannah, and also from the perspective of Princess Susan of Windsor, her beloved corgi. This wonderful novel is published by William Morrow and Company. Eliza Knight, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning.
Dig into the book in more specific fashion. I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about your own love of history. Tell us, to the best of your recollection, when and where and why and how that...
At the museum, just looking around and learning different things. But officially, I mostly remember is my first trip to France to visit my grandparents who lived there. And I was about 8 years old, and we visited Versailles, which, if you've ever been there,
at what point did it occur to you that your love of history could flow very nicely into the crafting of historical novels? When and how did that?
It was just something that, like, I always was innately drawn to. And when I actually did start writing, I explored other genres. But when I was in high school, for fun, I would write like these little historical time travels and Scottish things and French stories and things, like something that was always a part of me, to be honest.
Well, I absolutely love this newest novel, which again is called The Queen's Faithful Companion. I suspect we can chalk up this particular novel to a real interest in British history, and in particular history of the royal family. Tell us about the genesis of that particular facet of your love of history.
Sure. I've always been fascinated by royals, and particularly the, I studied a lot with the Tudor period and wrote several novels in that era prior to sort of moving forward in time to the 1900s. But I've just sort of always felt like the Queen was someone to be admired. She was the longest reigning monarch in England, and her love of corgis, it was something that I think the modern person knows about, but I don't know that they knew how far back it went. And I saw this really cute video of her. I need to find out more about her relationship with these corgis and why they're so important to her. And what I found out was that she had a corgi, the family had a corgi when she was a child named Dookie, which was short for, it was a nickname for Duke. And for her 18th birthday, her father gifted her her very own corgi, which was Susan. And Susan ended up being the matriarch of 14 generations of Windsor corgis that the Queen bred herself. And I just found that to be super fascinating. She never sold them. She only ever gifted them to family, friends, some of her staff. They just meant so much to her. And I wanted to explore what that was all about and her relationship. And I think part of the reason that Susan was so important to her was that link to her father. And we know her father passed on much earlier than anyone expected, especially Elizabeth. And so she kind of was able to live with her father's memory through the dog. And interestingly enough, Susan was so important to her that she actually snuck her on her honeymoon, hid her beneath some blankets. Prince Philip didn't even...
Tell us a little more about your own impressions of Queen Elizabeth II herself, even before we get into this interesting aspect of her, a whole lot more than her relationship with this beloved pet, but we follow all kinds of other events from her life and learn a whole lot about who she was. Just give us a sense of your own fascination with the woman herself, and if in particular there are things about her that you especially admired or especially found especially intriguing.
Sure. Sure. So what I find really fascinating and that I admire a lot about her is that she was a working mom. And as a working mother myself, that's something, you know, balance with life and job and responsibility is often something that I struggle with, my friends struggle with, other women struggle with. And she really did it with panache. I mean, she was the queen of a country. She had her children and she really tried to do it all. And she I think that that was a really good example, not only for the women of her generation, but generations to come, in that she was able to kind of share that she could be the matriarch of a really important family and also the queen mother of a country and its other properties. So I just that was one of the things that I really admired about her the most, was her work ethic and her devotion to her family.
Your book focuses on three different voices, if you will. That is, sometimes we are viewing events from the perspective of Elizabeth herself, not literally in her voice. She is not the narrator, but the book's narrator is. It's as though they are with Elizabeth and viewing things as she viewed them. Sometimes we are actually experiencing things through the eyes of Susan, that beloved corgi, and I'm going to ask you later about the challenge of that. But also, there is a third character who is also crucial to the telling of this story, and that is somebody who is a servant named Hannah. This character is fictional. Entirely fictional, although maybe loosely based on somebody who actually worked for the Queen. Tell us more about the character of Hannah and why you thought it was important that she be an element in the story of this of Elizabeth at this portion of her life.
So Hannah is based on a couple of different people who were the keeper of the Queen's corgis, like you mentioned. The first set was actually a couple, and the second one was a man named Bill Fenwick. And being a queen, she was very busy with her different responsibilities, especially if she was traveling. But the real, you know, reason, besides being able to share that amazing job, which I think would be really fun to have, was that I wanted to be able to have a character that could see the queen from their position as a staff person. You know, this would be even confide in a little bit, that would be different than the dog, so that she could have sort of like this human connection and human contact and a little bit of a friendship, if you will, even though friends were not necessarily something the queen would become with a staff member. But one thing that led me to believe that she really cared so much for her keepers was that when Bill Fenwick passed away, she actually attended the funeral and took his corgi that she had gifted him years before into her home. And as a rule, the queen did not attend funerals of her staff members. And the reason, because...
A novel of Queen Elizabeth II and her beloved corgi, Susan. The book is based on the historical life of Queen Elizabeth II, but a particular portion of her life, beginning when she was a young teenager through to when she accedes to the throne upon her father's death, and then a few years into her reign. And we are viewing these events from her perspective, from the perspective of her servant Hannah, and from the perspective of her beloved corgi, Susan. In the Eliza Knight, in the author's note, you say, "I'm not a dog expert, and I don't pretend to be." But you say earlier in the author's note, "I come from a large family of humans and dogs." Tell us more about your family, and in particular, the place that dogs have had in the collective life of your family, and particularly in your own family, in your own life.
Sure. So I love dogs. I've grown up with dogs. We've had labs, boxers, cocker spaniels, corgis. So, and right now I have a Newfoundland and a half Newfie, half Lab mix. So I've just grown up around dogs, loved them. My Newfie totally side-eyes me and I feel very judged by her. But I just find that the relationship is something that's really important to me and my family too. So some of my favorite times is when, I think that's basically where that note comes from. And when I was deciding that I wanted to write this story and explore Susan's part in the Queen's life, I thought, you know what, the best way to do that is actually to get inside Susan's head and share Susan's perspective. And I was, you know, nervous about approaching my editor with this, and she was like a little bit nervous about probably me writing it, but she asked to see some pages, and so I wrote the first chapter of Susan's point of view, and she loved it. So I was really, really happy that they let me do that in the book and be able to get inside more of a dog's head and actually be able to understand them a little bit more than I thought I already did.
Right. And I think it really does work wonderfully well. There is a sense in which the style of writing changes when we are, in a sense, in the mind of the corgi, Susan. If you can, sort of take us inside your process of actually putting words on the page and, in a sense, trying to give them a different flavor from some of the other writing in the book, in which we are hearing from, in a sense, a nameless narrator. In these particular chapters, it is, in a sense, Corgi herself, Susan, Susan the Corgi, speaking to us directly. What did you think about in terms of choice of language, choice of words, shaping these particular chapters?
Yeah, so I had to actually put myself in a dog's mindset. First of all, they don't know a lot of the things that we're doing. They just think we're, you know, walking around talking into, you know, when we're talking into the phone, they're like, why is she holding that thing talking into it? Why can I hear a voice through it? They don't understand what that is. So there was a lot of little funny things I added because I, you know, realizing a dog wouldn't actually know what this is and they see us doing these strange things. And then the other thing is that dogs, they really can sense our emotions. They can sense when you're sick. And so thinking about that, I had to think about what Susan might be viewing, what she might be smelling, what her senses might be experiencing when other characters are experiencing something. And I did a lot of research on dogs in particular, just so I can make sure that I got some of these things right. Like, for example, if you're scared, they can hear that and they can smell the difference in our perspiration versus, you know, if we're just sweating because we're exercising versus if we're sweating because we're scared about something in a healthy body versus a non-healthy body. So I wanted to make sure that I put sort of like the senses of what a dog might experience and then also some of those little funnier things about them observing us and wondering, you know, what we're doing. But then also there was a lot of talk about Susan's relationship with chewing on the furniture. So I wanted to kind of give her a little motivation. Why is she chewing on the furniture legs? And, you know, how does she feel about the other dogs in the house? Or how does she feel about some of the staff members who may not have been particularly friendly to her? So it was really just getting myself down on her level and trying to think about what a dog might see or sense or feel in moment. And that was, it was a really fun exercise. I really enjoyed writing those chapters.
Right. And I really do appreciate how in those particular chapters, there is a slight simplification of language. It's not quite as though, I mean, English is Susan's second language. It isn't quite to that extent, but we just have a sense that we are hearing from someone other than the book's narrator. And I really think it works wonderfully well. We're speaking
Thank
with
you.
Eliza Knight. We're talking with Eliza Knight about her new novel, The Queen's Faithful Companion, a novel of Queen Elizabeth II and her beloved corgi, Susan. Your novel actually begins in late December 1939. And almost right away, we see reference made to then 13-year-old Princess Lilibet, L-I-L-I-B-E-T. Tell us what you kind of found out about this period of British history and what you were most anxious to convey in your novel, The Queen's Faithful Companion.
Sure. So the thing I really wanted to convey the most with that beginning chapter is the fear of what's to come and the separation between the parents and the children. So, you know, the young princesses were sent away just like the other children in London at the time because they were, what's going to happen next? And I really wanted to kind of convey that, but also to show that a lot of people may not know that just because they're princesses.
Really, it's on Christmas that most of this chapter sort of unfolds. And Christmas itself becomes kind of a recurring theme in your novel. Was that for any particular reason?
Well, I wanted to show in that chapter, in particular, the family's gifting of cookies and toys to the dogs. It was a time for family and celebration, and it was something that they wanted to kind of share with the people.
The book very quickly moves to early 1944. And this is just ahead of Elizabeth's 18th birthday, which is actually in April, is written. And of course, a lot of us can think about having been on the other side of what it's like as a human being to look into a little bin or a cage or crate and see all these adorable puppies. But the way you've written this chapter, we are in the perspective of one of those puppies looking out and listening and experiencing this. Tell us more about what it was like for you to try to place yourself into the perspective of this young puppy just born and just about to have their life dramatically changed.
So I just imagined what it would be like snuggling up with a bunch of puppies. And, you know, and puppies, they like to climb in and around each other and be warm. And they like to listen to the heartbeat of their mother and then also each other. So I kind of put myself in that perspective. But also I wanted her to explore sort of like the sense. So she has a little bit of a, you know, she's a puppy, obviously, but there's a little bit of a maturity there. So it's kind of sweet in one way, but a little bit like deeply emotional in another.
Would it be okay if I read just a little bit of this chapter for our listeners?
Of course.
So this is chapter one. And again, this is from the perspective of this little corgi puppy. I am stretching now, feeling very at home as the squeaks of my brothers and sisters sound around me, the comforting tones of my mother's heavy panting. And then, magic. The delighted sound of human voices reaches me where I lie cozily. Not the humans who were raising me, different ones. They don't all sound the same, humans, but the vibrations inside their necks mix with the formations of their shortened tongues, creating an enchanting noise. Words. The deeper voice. Ah, that's Pippa. That's me. I'm Hickathrift Pippa, a Pembroke Welsh corgi. Pippa. I can hear the grin in his voice, and then he wraps me up in his large five-fingered paws and lifts me into the air. I startle, my stubby limbs straightening out, and I have that strange feeling of falling with no place cushion between us. Companion.
Crumpled paper, for sure, in every chapter. But surprisingly, Susan's chapters came to me much more naturally than the Queen's chapters herself. And I think that's because they were much more, emotional and maybe even like primal, I guess. So that, like you mentioned earlier, they're a little more simpler and, you know, because we're just in this dog's head. And so I think, I don't know why they came to me more naturally, but they were really fun and different. And I think maybe that's part of it, is that I was sort of exploring a different, really sweet voice and getting inside the mind of a dog and what they would see and feel. And it just, I don't know. It came. Maybe I was a dog in another life. I'm not sure. It just came up really naturally.
Very good. Very good. So eventually, young Elizabeth or Lilibet is presented with this beautiful puppy. It is an amazing surprise for her. And it comes at a very interesting moment in her life as she turns 18. At one point, we read these words, "Now that she was 18, she expected her duties to increase. Being the future queen involved a great deal of responsibility. It was an honor, yes." Really interesting that you wanted to take the time for us to kind of ponder how life...
And things are definitely changing, whether you're graduating high school and going, you know, her father's going to start giving her more royal duties, that she's, you know, she's going to be responsible for a lot more.
I'm guessing, or within the family. And
yeah.
And they are very, very close, that is, these two sisters. And yet there are ways in which, of course, their personality over time. Tell us more about this relationship and Elizabeth's sister, Margaret, and what you were most anxious to highlight. And maybe also wrapped up in that question is, how did talking about this relationship help illuminate the most important character in your book, which is, of course, Elizabeth herself?
In mother's company, as is evidenced up through the fact that, you know, later on in Margaret's life, she gave up, which a lot of us wouldn't have to struggle with, is that she can't always give her sister the happiness that she wants because the crown could do as far as, you know, family was concerned, and show that the level of respect that's required for that, but also just sort of like the trauma that might come from not being able to do what you want because of responsibility. And I think that their relationship was a really good example of that in particular. And I also wanted to show sort of the difference in their personalities, because it was well documented that Margaret was, you know, very carefree, charismatic, sort of like a party animal, if you will. And she was, you know, that like wild child versus the queen, who was much more reserved, much more serious. But behind closed doors, Elizabeth was also silly and funny, too. And a lot of people say that she had quite a sense of humor. So I think that was something that she saved for her family. And that was another reason that her and her sister got along so well, is that they both shared a similar sense of humor.
I want to mention that these events in 1944 include a really scary moment in which there is a Nazi plane dropping bombs really close. And the young servant, mm-hmm. Hannah, needs to take the corgi down into a bomb shelter. And I think for a lot of us, we remember reading about the sort of the Blitz, the London Blitz, that occurred quite early in the Second World War. And we sometimes forget that this was a perpetual reality that lasted a whole lot longer than just 1940. And I think you do mm-hmm. such a good job of helping us kind of understand the fear of being caught in something like that.
Well, thank you.
There,
yeah, I only wanted that had a weird, like, whirring noise.
Susan the Corgi, in the chapter in which it's the Corgi's perspective, we read these words at one point. "That's where the smell is coming from, the scary smell. I quiver. Whatever it is, this monster with the black paw reaching into the sky, is it going to get us? I worry for Lilibet, Margot, the king, the queen, the man who cooks my food, and the ones who make my bed. Something is wrong, terribly wrong. Crackers," that's another dog, "starts barking at the sky, and I run toward him, adding my own voice to the alarm. If we're to be the ones to keep these humans safe, we have to make sure they understand the danger." And for any of us who own dogs, who have experienced a dog sounding the alarm, that's an especially delicious passage. We eventually see young Elizabeth undergoing some training to be an ATS driver. And this is something that she undertakes of her own free will, wanting to be actively serving her country in a way apart from just being a member of the royal family, something that she finds thrilling and deeply satisfying. And again, for anyone who has followed the story of Queen Elizabeth, they know that this is
something. Part of this community, an active part of this country, that she was willing to fight for her country. And I think that was something that I wanted to convey to the that this is not an ordinary royal, her country, willing to sacrifice herself for her country. And I think that is just something to be really admired and respected. And I wanted to make sure that I showed that, like, you know, her determination. And even though she didn't serve for very long, nobody knew when.
Thinking to herself, Lilibet had set out to prove to the other cadets and to herself that she was more than to keep her country safe. Ultimately, one of the most important relationships that we learn about in this book is young Elizabeth's relationship with and eventually fervent love for Philip, the man who would ultimately become her husband. And I think you do such a wonderful job of kind of taking us inside her heart and what she is feeling.
I had seen, even before I started researching this book, and I still really love it, and I hope all of you go Google search it right now, is this adorable little picture with Philip. He's dressed outside as a guard at Buckingham Palace. He's got on the tall black furry hat, and the Queen is walking past him with a little smile. You see that he is smiling a little bit too, and she looks almost like she's laughing. And, I mean, they're quite aged at that point. I think it's probably a picture from 10 or 15 years ago. But in that picture, you can see that there is a love and a sense of humor and all of that still going strong at that age. And I mean, they were married for over 70 years, and to have that relationship still going strong at that point, I thought, well, they must have really, really, it's probably what helped them sustain such a lasting relationship. But one of the things that they struggled with, and I think she struggled with too, was the growing responsibilities of being a royal, and then further than that, becoming queen. So prior to her becoming queen, and they thought that that was not going to be for a very long time, they really tried to step away from royal life. So, you know, he was in the Navy, and he was stationed over in Malta. And she would go over to Malta and basically pretend she was just a Navy wife. You know, she wasn't princess and heir to the throne. She was just trying to live sort of like what it would be like to have a normal life. And I think that was really important to her. But then, you know, all of a sudden the king passes away unexpectedly, and she's now becoming queen. And because of the age, you know, 1950s, I think that it was a difficult transition for not just Philip, but for her a little bit too. So she had, you know, had a number of years knowing that she was going to be queen. And I think that she did that for a number of reasons. One, her father, I believe, asked her, but also she wanted to set a precedent that this was her responsibility. This was her position, had to be named after the royal household. So there's a lot going on there, and I think that was a period of time in their lives.
To her responsibilities, obviously also made other aspects of their lives difficult. And yet, we come away with a great admiration for Philip and the role, the very important role that he played in her life and during her reign. Mm-hmm. At one point when Philip is back from his own military deployment after the end of the Second World War, and they have gathered, and he's telling, she thought to herself, "You must remain informed of the goings-on beyond the palace walls. One day you will be queen." She looked at him again. When the time came to rule, she would need a man like Philip at her side from disaster. Just one of many remarkable passages in this novel, The Queen's Faithful Companion, a novel of Queen Elizabeth II and her beloved corgi, Susan, published by William Morrow, the author Eliza Knight. Eliza Knight, congratulations on a wonderful book.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me on the show. I really enjoyed chatting with you about the book.
Eliza,
Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News from Gateway Technical College. Coming up at 9 o'clock, the Wisconsin Today program from Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's check the forecast details now from the National Weather Service. Lovely day today, sunny and mild, a high of 73 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. Tonight, sunset 8:35, cloudy and mild, a low of 58. Friday looks to be a rainy day, 60% chance of rain. Friday's high 79. A hot one for Saturday, 30% chance of morning rain, afternoon high 86 on Saturday. And then sunny and 68 for Sunday. Now 66 degrees Kenosha, 65 in Racine. We're approaching 9 o'clock. Wisconsin Today is next.